This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we have a rebroadcast of an interview with Western Michigan University history professor James Cousins. We discussed his book, Horace Holly, Transylvania University, and the Making of Liberal Education in the Early American Republic. The interview originally aired in January. James Cousins, thanks for being here.
Gordon, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
As a historian, what made you want to look at Horace Holly, his time at Transylvania University, and his life in general in terms of how it relates to education?
Yeah. Well, I've always been attracted to the creation of the American West and the idea of America reinventing itself and how that plays out on the frontier is a really intriguing story for so many different reasons. Americans are moving out west for new opportunities, and that sense of sort of boundless optimism that Americans have. And that really comes to a kind of a crescendo in their ideas for education and higher education in particular. And they take it seriously. And so small towns like Lexington, Kentucky, like Cincinnati, like Louisville, like St. Louis, really see their future in education. And Horace Holly, who is attributed with many things, one of which being the creation or the popularization of medicine in the West, is credited with bringing a new sense of higher education to the West, to Lexington. So it's an intriguing story. I wanted to write it in, as a biography, because I think it really encapsulates so many of the nuances of what's happening, the migration west, and in Horace's case, from Boston out west and then down south to New Orleans. It's a good story. It's one that hasn't been told, and there's not a lot out there on higher education in the early 1810s and 20s, which is unfortunate because this is a really unique time in the history of education. It's one when the higher education is really kind of coming into its own. It's emerging from this really denominational, religiously centered idea to a more secular orientation.
Do you have any thoughts on why it is that there hasn't been more written about this, especially in, you know, recent decades, you know, that this is sort of maybe mined soil for someone like yourself who's a historian?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. It's a difficult story to tell, mostly because the sources are sort of scattered, and Horace's life represents that. I mean, really putting this together was a feat. And they're all over, and historians up to now have chosen to tell the story of education through institutional histories, which are, you know, interesting to some people, but, you know, not really all that compelling to many others. And I think biography is a great way to tell the story, one that I think will not just attract a wider audience, but, you know, tell a story and all of its nuances in a way that really just kind of makes sense of everything that's included and everything that's involved.
Horace Holly's father grew up with very little in the way of formal education, and yet really tried to see to it that his children did go on and get formal education, go on to college. That's a fairly standard American story in a lot of ways. Did it have an influence on Horace going forward into his professional life?
Right. And, you know, and the point to take from that, and that's a good question, was this is really brand new for American families. And Horace's father is a member of a rising merchant class, traders who, you know, deal in dry goods and are selling goods all over the, in Horace's father's case, New England states, and coming into money for the first time in their family's history, and what to do with that money and how to spend that money. And Horace has five brothers, and they all go to college, and that's brand new. And why the brothers go to college and why the father sends them to college is, you know, part of, you know, what I'm trying to tell, that story about, you know, the pull of education at this, in this period. It's about prestige, obviously. It's about, you know, families feeling that they're coming into their own. It's about also, you know, where the priorities of the family, just where their reach kind of ends and what they're capable of doing ends. And I think in Horace's case, it was about sending him to college to get that kind of moral character building, something that he couldn't get in the far west reaches of Connecticut. So they have to send him to Williams College first, in Massachusetts. And then Horace elects to go to Yale ultimately. But it was to get that kind of moral bearing, which is, something we don't attribute to higher education these days, but was very much a part of what it meant to be educated.
And there's a certain transformation that goes on with Horace Holly, especially when he's at Yale. At one point, he comes back and he finds himself really arguing with his father over the events of the day. And again, something that is kind of a standard American story in a lot of
ways.
Sure.
You know, it's the interesting part about that exchange in particular is because it kind of lends itself to how fervently institutions were attempting to inculcate students with a particular set of political priorities. And in this case, it was federalism. And Horace writes, a number of letters, espousing the virtues of, strong central government and really just kind of defaming, what it is that farmers do. And Horace's father takes great exception to this, obviously. But, the students at Yale held ceremonies in the honor of, John Adams and the Federalist Party regularly. And it was really just kind of everything was united as one. I mean, instructors, the president, they all worked together, in this very focused political mindset. And that's an interesting story.
It's also interesting that for a time, Horace feels rather uncomfortable at Yale. But by the end, he says that he finds that he enjoys it. You say that he found that he could live the life of a scholar
well.
Yeah. There was certainly a transformation that happens for him along the way.
Yeah, it came down to money, first, but yeah, and writing home for money and, so his family could keep him in the style that I think most students at Yale were accustomed to, swallowtail coats and, fineries. But the other point is, so with politics was also this equally strong kind of pull to religious conviction. And the Second Great Awakening is sweeping through New England, and Horace is caught up with this, and the students at Yale are. And so mass conversions at Yale and at other colleges in the Northeast, and Horace is pulled into this and comes out of Yale with a new sense of himself. So this very kind of courageous attitude towards religion and to sort of proselytization and spreading the message. And he comes out as a strong Calvinist with, set on becoming a minister,
And that's exactly where he goes when he graduates from college.
Well, there's a time.
Oh, there's a detour, right?
There's a detour to the law, but just a couple months. But it's an important side note because this gives him the credentials years later to teach law by virtue of 2 years of apprenticeship in New York. But then he returns to Yale and finishes his theological training, which is, studying under Timothy Dwight, set of readings, and then, just kind of working for a year until Dwight feels that he's ready to move on and, sit for his ordination.
You tell us many times in this book that there are a lot of things that are really hard to know because the record is not quite as complete as you would like it to be,
right,
as someone studying it. But I guess I'm wondering, did you get the sense that he would have been happy remaining in religion, or was the call of being a university administrator or a university president something that he would have eventually sought out?
That's another really good question. And it's part of the reason why I chose Horace to tell this story, because of his optimism and enthusiasm and his drive and what he wanted for himself was so much bigger. I think his attraction to the ministry was part of, that drive. And he saw himself as an influential figure in the mode of Timothy Dwight, who was the president of Yale, who had a very successful pastorate, and Horace was in this along this track and gets employment at the Hollis Street Church in Boston, and is quite successful there and has a very large congregation, and so much so that they have to move to a new church, and his reputation spreads that way, and wants to build on this reputation and wants to see it expand. Now, why he doesn't choose politics is, I think, an interesting question. But he doesn't, and he sees an opportunity for himself in education. And and is appointed, and in 1815, you don't apply for a job. Someone knocks on your door and says you've been appointed president of Transylvania University in Kentucky, and he says, "Where is that? And how do I get there?"
But actually, the first couple times he was contacted, he turned them down, right?
Right, he did. He did. Because of some denominational, infighting in the Board of Trustees. And then the state corrects this by removing the board entirely and replacing them with state officials, and this, giving him, a free reign over education and a better environment, I think.
He also gets contacted, and then he's got to make this trip to Lexington to make sure that this is what he wants to do. And, of course, reading this in 2016, your thought now, of course, if someone is coming to a campus, like Western Michigan University, where there's a presidential search going on, someone gets flown into the airport, they're brought to the campus. Well, of course, we're talking here the 18-teens, so people were not flying planes at this point. But he decides to take his journey from Boston to Lexington in such a way that he can visit other campuses. So what was he trying to find out?
It's a really important point, and that's a really important chapter in it, because it tells the story of what education is in 1818, when he takes this trip out to Kentucky to observe and see if the job is right for him. And so he knows education from one perspective, and as being a student at Williams and then Yale. He was on the Board of Overseers, which is sort of the Board of Trustees at Harvard, for a time, but really didn't know how to administer a university, how to lead a university. So he takes this opportunity to visit every major institution. And so he goes from Boston, and he visits New York and Columbia College, the College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton, down to Baltimore and some other universities along the way. And what he finds, and this is made very clear in his trip to Philadelphia and the University of Pennsylvania, is that the only distinguishing factor in education, the one that sets one institution apart from another, is medicine. And a college with a school or a department of medicine was seen as having what he termed the eclat of education. And that's really where you got the most sort of cultural capital in and among elite circles, when you had, the attraction and that pull. And so that's one of the very first things that he sets out to do in Kentucky, is build. And they had a school of medicine, but just sort of was on life support. And Horace rebuilds that from the ground up and sees that as the most important factor in higher education. But he only learns this on the trip. And he gets which was an attempt to just kind of draw a consensus and figure out what those kind of touch points were in education. And that's one of the things he comes up with.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We're bringing you a rebroadcast of an interview with Western Michigan University history professor James Cousins. He is the author of Horace Holly, Transylvania University, and the Making of Liberal Education in the Early American Republic. The interview originally aired in January.
There's some opportunity here for some clashes. We have someone coming from Boston to Lexington, Kentucky. We have someone who has been a preacher. He's not really been a university president. So how did all of this work out in the early time that Horace Holly's in Lexington? Do the clashes flare up, or is he able to smooth it over because he has some ideas and seems to have big plans for the university?
It's a question about regional differences, and that, the palpable sense that one group is just different from another and just will remain so. Horace wants to write a travel journal when he's on this trip in 1818 and publish it. And his friends say he'll have great success simply because there's not that much out there. And anytime you're publishing, you've been to South Carolina. That's fascinating. What are the people there like? And so he's very careful to catalog the differences in speech and how they talk and how they act. On his trip down south, for instance, he talks about how very, very different the South is from the Northeast, and looks ahead 20, 30 years and sees war as inevitable because of slavery and some other things. When he comes out to Lexington, those regional differences are permanent. The locals really can't adjust to him or his wife in any meaningful way. In social circles, they really struggle to just find a middle ground, a dialogue. It's something that lasts and stays with them. Horace is always seen as being an elitist, and most of that is attributable to his dialect, his regional dialect. His wife, Mary Austin Holly, never sees much cultural enrichment in Lexington and makes frequent trips back east. They're never really at home in Lexington, and that I think is part of the problem.
But you also say in this book that he did not do an especially good job of balancing the idea of populism and elitism, and that in a lot of ways he had some pretty elitist tendencies that governed the way that he ran Transylvania University.
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, it's owing to the nature of higher education in Horace's mind was it was by elites for elites, and a broader educational mission, spreading it to the masses, was really, not appropriate for the time. So it was about getting the best instructors, charging a premium price for education, and expecting the best from his students. This did not play well in an environment where, this is kind of emerging into the Jacksonian era, and populist tendencies where Americans who really didn't understand what higher education was about and absolutely did not understand why the state should support higher education saw no need for it. And this is, so with a new governor in Kentucky in 1824, new populist governor, and the removal of state funds, that really sort of sets Horace on this path to remove himself from Lexington and find another path for his ambitions. And he ends up with a similar position at the University of New Orleans.
Although things kind of went awry there as well, right?
They did. So he goes there first with the intention of conducting what he termed a traveling academy, where he'd take the wealthy children from plantation owners, and on this sort of European tour of great courts and houses of governance, and there they would learn firsthand from ancient sites and interesting people, and it's too expensive, and the fathers of these sons who first promised him these ideas back away, and they say, but we have the University of New Orleans for you to consider, and we'd love you to consider the presidency there and to build it from the ground up. And Horace's optimism, again, he sees New Orleans now as the great emporium of the West, and sets his sight on creating the university up from whole cloth and attracting new professors and really redoing everything that he did in Lexington. And things didn't work out there simply because he died of yellow fever. But if they hadn't worked out and if he had survived, I have every confidence that he would have moved on and gone somewhere else and tried the whole thing again. This is just part of America's story in the early Republic, where we're just kind of recreating, and this sense of enthusiasm and just driven by a greater purpose to remake the West.
Back to his time in Lexington for a moment. Were there some legitimate concerns? I mean, you tell us that both in his work life and in his private life, he was not necessarily the best man to have his hands on money. And were there some legitimate criticisms of him in terms of how finances were managed at the university?
You know, it's a story about somebody who just really didn't understand how to manage a university in so many ways. He was a spendthrift, and,
including in his own private life. Right.
Yeah. He enjoyed parties and bringing people in. As much as he couldn't get along with the local populace, he entertained as much as he could. But the management of the college, financial management, was a challenge for him, just kind of keeping the books balanced. And he was always in Frankfurt trying to seek more money because he'd spend it all. And he spent lavishly on his faculty, which is, I think, a great trait
for
all administrators to have. But he spent on his faculty, and he attracted some excellent faculty. But when they were there, he really didn't know what to do with them. So he attracts this naturalist, Constantine Raffinesque. And Raffinesque is a really interesting character. Someone's written there's been a few biographies of Raffinesque, but he's from Constantinople when it was Constantinople, and he comes to America to study and to identify new species of plants and animals. And one of the trustees really takes a shine to Constantine Raffinesque and enjoys him, and Horace comes into contact with him and asks him to teach at Transylvania, and he does for a time. But Horace never really understands what naturalists do, and he would wander into Constantine's office and see the room just kind of crowded with, you know, plants and rocks, and, you know, ask him what weeds were. And Constantine would go out on, you know, trips where he'd be gone for 2 or 3 weeks and at a time and gone. And Horace eventually gets fed up with this and throws all of his stuff out. And Constantine leaves the university and casts a curse on the university and so on and so forth. The medical college was Horace's crowning achievement, but really didn't get what they did there. Thought he could be an active part of it, so he wants to take part in the examination process. But the students rebel because Horace has no medical training, and they don't want him involved at all. And so they all threaten to quit, and he quells that rebellion by removing himself from it. And he turns it over to Charles Caldwell, who is really credited with the medical college's rise to prominence. So he knew how to attract really good people, and there's other stories. Didn't know how to fund them, and when they were here, didn't really know what to do with them. But he could put some things in motion that were very useful.
The introduction to your book begins with the story of Lafayette coming to Transylvania University, and this is a big event in 1825, grand ceremony. And then just a few months later, the university and its president, Horace Holly, are rebuked by Kentucky's governor. So was this a situation where the problems had just been brewing for a long time, or was there sort of a sea change politically that came all of a sudden and maybe caught Horace Holly and his supporters off guard?
Yeah, it was both. And it really sets up this really interesting tension between so these local towns that are all in the West trying to prove themselves to be the sort of next center of great commerce. And Lexington in 1825 has lost a lot to steamboat traffic on the Mississippi. And so this is the rise now of St. Louis and Louisville in particular. Having Lafayette and other great dignitaries always meant something in terms of the just kind of rising esteem of the town. But how this meshed with, you know, another really prominent strain of, you know, this political move to populism and the realization that the state is going to defund higher education was significant. Lexington is known for one or two things in 1825, and one is Transylvania University. The other is the rope industry, really, not horse racing yet, but their fates were intertwined, and the locals, the citizens of Lexington, really understood that as much as so many, Chillicothe is another Chillicothe in Ohio, another interesting example, and other small towns that are not necessarily on major waterways and didn't have another sort of means of kind of providing for themselves and saw education as a way to boost their incomes. And so went the Transylvania University, so went Lexington. And when Horace leaves and the state funding leaves, the town is, kind of left to its own devices. And there's a real period of decline and decay that sets in, and which is the reason why we don't hear of Transylvania University all that much today.
Although it still is in existence.
It is, yes.
But yeah. It's a private school.
It is a private school, a couple thousand enrolled. It's a great school.
And of course, when people now think of a school in Lexington, they're more likely to think of the University of
Kentucky.
And you're a proud graduate.
I am. Alma mater, right.
as someone who is a professor, works in the world of academia, are there things that you find when you research Horace Holly that you say, oh, that's why we do that, or that lives on today in the world of professorship?
Yeah, I think particularly with the regimentation of schools and schooling, you know, the assigning of bells and just, you know, there really were not meant to be gaps in the day. So idle hands are the devil's work is what Horace would say. But so to not give them the freedom or flexibility to sort of think independently from classes, but just that very, very regimented run through a day, the progress of the day. I think the training in foreign languages is another kind of holdover. It is today, obviously, a great way to experience cultures, unique and international cultures. In Horace's day, you were not meant to become proficient in Latin. It was a tool to teach character and rigor and mental discipline. And this is something that he is very fond of, and he tries his best to master not just Latin, but French and German and other languages as a sign of his erudition, his cultivation, but also his persistence, what we would term today as grit, I think, and saw that as really a cornerstone of a youth education.
So as I noted, there are some things you said you could not really get at in this book. This record is far from complete. If you had to pick one thing that you could have found that you think would have fleshed this story out just a little bit more, do you have something that comes to mind?
Jefferson Davis's time at Transylvania University is a great question, and people have tried to, you know, there's just so little on it. He fails math at one point, and he has to repeat it, and he finds that humiliating, and I think that, you know, forces him to go on to West Point and just kind of leave. But that's an interesting story. I think the student perspectives, we have some of them from the time, but they're difficult to the genuine expressions. And that's why, you know, Horace's tale is really interesting. His correspondence with his brothers at Williams and at Yale and throughout his life, really, about educational ideas. You don't really see much of that. And so how students are imbibing information and what they're doing with it, what their ideas and their hopes are. We get student orations and things that are published and because they're meant to be published. But how well that really reflected their moral sensibilities, their, you know, character development and their aspirations in life. I mean, I think more of that would have been interesting. There's some of that, but I think more would be better.
If you had to give a quick shorthand sentence or two to sum up the legacy of Horace Holly, what would you say?
I'd say that Horace reflects a period of academic aspiration and something that we have in great quantities today, the idea that education can lift us up out of our circumstances, obviously, but that education is training for the republic, that it's good moral and character training for responsible citizenship. And Horace encapsulates these ideas. He tries to get at them through other means and methods. But that really is, I think, one of his lasting legacies. And the fact that you can extract religion from higher education and develop morality through secular means and methods, I think Horace and his contemporaries and Sylvanus Thayer at West Point and some other prominent presidents who are his contemporaries really kind of share in that legacy.
James Cousins, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
James Cousins is a professor of history at Western Michigan University and also the author of Horace Holly, Transylvania University, and the Making of Liberal Education in the Early American Republic. The interview with James Cousins originally aired in January. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.